This podcast is brought to you by the Brett McMurphy Institute of Journalistic Integrity. Menace to society.
I want to start this podcast off with the biggest dirt I have on anyone. The biggest story, the biggest bomb I have to drop. Episode 1, Topic 1.
Oh shit.
Wait, what is that story? All right, so I want to start with this. In 2016, I was on the road recruiting, came back to Columbus Friday night, landed around midnight, right? I had parked at the office, so I Ubered to the office to get my truck. My keys were in my office, so I cut through the locker room to get to my office and get my keys and head home after a long week. I knew something was a little different because there were two cars in the parking lot. Usually when I get to the Woody Hayes Athletic Center at night, especially that hour,
there's no cars
in the parking lot. So sure enough, I walk into the locker room and I see the most disturbing thing my eyes have ever laid eyes on. So I walk in on President Drake, the university president, had an unnamed man performing oral sex on him in the players' lounge.
No fucking way.
Jesus.
Yeah, bro, I was shook, frozen. The remainder of my time at Ohio State never even looked me in the eye, not one time. It was the most uncomfortable experience I've had in my 35 years on this earth. So here's the thing about that. That story is completely false. I just made it up. But you believed it for a minute. And if I didn't just tell you I made it up, articles would have been written. He would have had to make a statement. Who knows? He might actually even gotten fired over it if the media ran with it enough. We'll get back to that in a minute, though. I really want to start off by saying thank you for tuning in. Whether it's out of support, out of hate, out of interest, or out of entertainment, we appreciate you taking the time to see what this is all about. Here is the value in this podcast. Here I am, a former college football coach that was in some historically monumental programs, meetings, games, lives, really. I have no desire ever to get back into coaching. Not that I could if I wanted to, but I don't want to do it. That gives me the greatest gift in the world, freedom. Freedom to say anything, tell any story, say things that no one else will or can. I have the liberated will to give everyone a perspective on so many things that no one ever has or can. I don't need messages about, you'll never coach again. What are you doing? I don't ever want to coach again. Never, ever. Don't want to. So here's what this podcast is intended to be. It's basically intended to be an insider perspective into college football and recruiting. An insider perspective into Urban Meyer, his program, the countless great players and stories associated with my experiences in one of the most elite programs in the history of college football. What really happened with OSU football, with my whole scandal, with the investigation, with all the key players, with my ex-wife. My experiences in several different venues in what is broken in our society today. Things like the law enforcement, the judicial system, the gender inequality, especially when it comes to divorces and custody. I also want to address some things that I've experienced, like social injustices and narrative warriors. Ultimately, this is going to be personal accounts, stories, and perspective into things that I think are relevant, impactful, and also entertaining. Here's what this podcast will not be. It will not be simplistic. It will also not be solely focused around the outrageous drama that was my life. Though some of that is relevant and important for me to get off my chest, it is not the intent or primary content driver for this podcast. Those stories may provide insight into the reality that was a colossal debacle for one of the largest, most powerful, and most popular athletic programs and coaches in the world. So they will be addressed. But make no mistake, that is not the focus of this podcast. The conception of this podcast came from one driving force, the messages and outpouring of support I received as life as I knew it crumbled in front of my eyes. The number of people with stories about similar life experiences. I then started reflecting on how could this happen? I know reality. I know what is real. Everyone I worked with knew reality and knew what was real. When I say everyone, I mean everyone. How could one person with a vendetta and a reason for revenge ruined so many lies? The reality of the how was simple. The issue that was weaponized against me is real. It is a horrible issue, a real issue, and people are outraged to stop it. Domestic violence, sexual assault, racial injustice, gender discriminations, all of these social issues are real, just like the one I faced was. They're horrific injustices to basic human rights. They are real, and everyone needs to take notice and do something to instigate and inspire change. But here's the danger with these issues. They are so real, so relevant, so detrimental to our society, that they hold the power to destroy an intended target. This is as it should be. The repercussions for someone who commits an act of violence or discrimination should be obliteration. The danger is in who is deciding the validity of these claims. You look all around the news, narrative warriors are everywhere pounding the table against these injustices with two weapons. One, reality. Two, narratives. Real situations can and should inspire change, outrage society, spark the debate, get people talking, and inspire action. But narratives? Narratives are weapons in these fights that self-destruct the cause. A false narrative that the social media narrative warriors can use to further support a cause only diminishes the ammunition they have in real accounts of said social injustices. An entirely false accusation of sexual assault only creates doubt for the real, horrible situations where it occurs. If narrative warriors want to be true social injustice warriors and make a change, they must do one thing to unite the cause. Treat actual false claims of said social injustice as they do perpetrators of social injustice. If there's false sexual abuse and it's proven, there should be outrage. I'm not talking about the instances where someone gets away with doing something that can't be proven. I'm talking about made-up accounts. If there's false domestic violence claims, we should not allow it. Because if we do, we undermine the power we have to change these injustices. I'm not saying this based on my story, nor am I sitting here trying to profess that I am innocent. I am simply saying what I went through gave me the perspective, and I see account after account where it happens. False accusations are weaponized by social injustice warriors, and they hurt the cause. That was something I had to get off my chest, because I see it all the time, and I experienced a part of that. And those accounts undermine the power that all of us have, and especially these people that are out fighting these injustices have, to change these injustices. So this podcast is intended to address issues that I have experienced firsthand, issues I feel very strongly about. But I also want to give listeners an inside look at the other end of the spectrum on many sensitive subjects. It also is going to address behind-the-scenes accounts and inconsistencies in several industries, like college football, The Ohio State University, Urban Meyer's program, the media, the legal system, law enforcement, divorce law, custody court, narratives, and so much more. My hope is that this can act as an avenue for people to relate to what is wrong with society on several fronts. I want to give my own experience into several different topics, and I think people will want to hear the other side of certain things that I've experienced. I'm really excited to share things I was a part of, witnessed, and experienced. I dealt with so many high-profile athletes and famous people and coaches. It's given me such a unique vantage point into things that are so interesting to the public. I tell stories to friends and family and even people that I meet, and they always are blown away with what I've seen, what I've witnessed, what I've experienced, things that I've went through, things that I saw people go through. Things like that happened at Ohio State or University of Florida with Urban Meyer, all the countless players I was around. Some extremely intimate details of the more prevalent icons in society, sports, and football that I came across. People that transcended athletics, for the good or bad, from the likes of some of the greats I was around, to the likes of some players and or coaches that stories were tragic and not so positive. Intimate accounts of positive icons like Michael Thomas's, Braxton Miller's, things that I went through with them, saw with them, their growth, their story. As well as insider stories on players that did not have storybook endings. One off the top of my head is Aaron Hernandez, who I spent a lot of time with. I want this podcast to expose reality on so many fronts, but also I want it to provide perspective on everything I've lived for the past 15 years. I'm extremely excited to share and think this will be something people will really enjoy. If you go to our website, www.menace2societypodcast.com, all of our avenues to access this podcast will be linked with additional content. Bookmark our website and definitely send us your email address so we can send you updates with new content is added. Subscribe to any and all of our channels. We will be on iTunes. We have a YouTube channel. We'll be on Google Play and on Spotify. Please leave comments and by all means, send us messages. We appreciate your feedback and think this could be an impactful vessel to educate, entertain, and inspire change. Now let's get to the podcast.
So your feedback has already been invaluable. We put it out there on social media and asked what everybody wants to hear.
Right.
We got hundreds and hundreds of responses.
Yep.
And we have about probably 50 to 75 topics that we want to cover. But one of the most common themes was the investigation. You know, what went on? What really happened during that investigation into your life, into what happened with Urban?
Right. I'll tell you this. I think the craziest thing is they launched this huge investigation, and Ohio State launched it, right? And so what I was sitting there, obviously on the other side of it, saying was, what is the reason for this investigation, right? What came out? What was the catalyst that caused it, right? Because the thing about everything that got reported later, obviously that stuff was not public. That's obvious. Mm-hmm. So the thing that blew my mind was, everything that was real that got reported, everyone at Ohio State already knew about. I mean, we had meetings about it. Urban and I, Urban Gene Smith and I, other coaches knew about it, knew that I had an ex-wife. I went through divorce. They knew that I was unfaithful. You know, they knew I owned my mistakes to everyone. I did what was reported to them. Mm-hmm. And they knew that I had a claim about domestic violence, right? They knew that that my ex was now, I mean, she was irate at me because here we got divorced and now I was going on going to be this successful coach. And out of revenge, she started claiming domestic violence, had domestic violence accusations.
Yeah.
And the thing about it was, don't get me wrong, I've said it 100 times and I don't want to go through this for the entire podcast, but right. It was a toxic relationship. There was definitely physical altercation, but I've never one time abused her, hit her, did anything aggressive at her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And all the people at Ohio State knew that. And they knew she was trying to expose me, destroy me because she was hurt. And I caused that. I'm not sitting here saying I didn't cause that. I was unfaithful because I was in a toxic marriage. And there's no excuse. I was in a toxic marriage. We should have just ended it, is what should have happened. But anyways, the people at Ohio State formed their own opinion. One, they reported everything to higher powers, right? And Urban said that in his interviews.
Yeah.
And then they based their opinion on whether to keep me at Ohio State or terminate me based on, number one, the law enforcement investigation, which I agree with people on social media that say that's not the end-all be-all. Does a law enforcement investigation always mean there was no domestic violence? Absolutely not. But the second reason why is they knew the people involved, both parties. And they knew their personalities and they knew what was real. So I'll tell you this. I should not have been fired because of domestic violence. In my opinion, I should have been fired after 2015 because I was a mess. My life was a mess. The reality of the divorce, losing my kids, starting my personal life over, it destroyed me and I didn't handle it well.
I remember.
And it was just... If you looked at the entire picture, you could see why, which I think is what Urban did. I mean, he obviously we had a relationship, but he didn't keep me on board because I was Earl Bruce's grandson.
Yes.
He did this with coaches throughout his entire career. If a coach was struggling in a certain area, it didn't matter what it was. It could be personal life. It could be offensive knowledge. It could be recruiting. It could be appearance. It could be anything. He didn't just fire them because they didn't know a lot of offensive football. He tried to develop them. So my personal life was an issue. It was not an issue before that. And it was not an issue after that. So he took it on upon himself to try to help me through that. And firing someone from him was so hard. I mean, he is a genuine person deep down. He cares about people. And he knew that just firing me because I was late and because I had these personal issues going on, that was going to impact not only me and my future. When he thought I was talented, he saw a future. But it would also impact my kids. It would impact how other people perceive the program. It would impact him. He took the big picture and said, "This is. I don't think I should fire him. I'm going to help develop him and coach him." And that was hard. He was hard on me. Really hard.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he took it all into account and decided for the betterment of yourself, for him, and for the program, it was better to try to develop you as a coach.
Well, yeah, and at the end of the day, he did what any great CEO would do. He said, one, did something happen that goes against the core values? One of his core values is treat women with respect, and he doesn't play with that. He loves his wife and his daughters more than anything in the world. So if he thought that happened, I would have got fired immediately, and he told me that, and I said that in the investigation.
Yeah.
When they asked me in the investigation, I said, listen, he told me when it all started, he said, if I find out there's 1 ounce of truth to this, you're gone. Don't even come talk to me. Clear out your office and don't come back.
Yeah, that's question one.
Absolutely.
Is there any validity to this?
Right, and that was the whole thing. But as I fast forward from then until June of 2018, right, a month before I got fired, he and I had an annual meeting in June. Him and all of his assistants do it. It's a performance review. He meets with you one-on-one, goes through the calendar year before, tells you what your strengths were, weaknesses, makes a plan to improve you, you know, like any manager does. And that meeting was all about how great of a year I had in the 2017 season and 2018 spring. And everything turned around after a colossally bad situation, and it all turned around, and the trajectory of my career was on a major upswing. And our whole meeting was about how after that next season I could be a coordinator, and how we needed to make a plan that I would be a head coach in 3 years. That was the whole meeting. There was very little negative talked about. He gave me some productive criticism,
obviously, yeah.
But that was the whole thing. And that's what pissed me off about. So the only thing that pissed me off about how he handled it was that where I was at professionally the day I was fired, and him knowing the validity of what the claims that were being reported, I know how impossible what it was for him to still support me because of the narrative. But when he said bad decision to hire me, that's not true. He didn't believe that.
There's no way.
I mean, 6 months earlier, he's sitting there telling me that I was going to be a head coach in 3 years.
Right.
And then a month later, bad decision for hiring me. Come on, man.
Yeah. Well, that's all just crazy. But where are you now? You know, in the aftermath of everything, how's everything going? What's going on? Obviously, there's been legal things that have gone on, and you have to go through them. But what impact has it had on you? Has it had on your kids? Things like that.
I mean, it definitely was really hard, and you can imagine, and I own a lot of blame in it, but it was really hard on my kids for sure. I mean, they were getting questions from people, and to be honest, they're in a good community, so it wasn't a lot of specific stuff. Most people didn't want to talk to them about it, but I remember one time, like I went to school to have lunch with my daughter, and I was having fun with her and her friends, and one of her friends said my daughter had gotten up to go. I had given her some money for like a jump-a-thon. She had went up, and one little girl said, "What's your name?" And I can't remember what I said. I said, like, "John." And she was like, "No, it's not." And I was like, "What do you mean?" "Yeah, it is. My name's John." And she was like, "You're Zach." And I was like, "How do you know that?" And she was like, "My dad told me he saw on TV that it was Zach." And I was like, holy cow, man. So that's the hard part about, I guess, the public eye, right?
Yeah.
Other than that, I mean, my kids took it hard at first. Then they were doing great. But the biggest thing going on is now you have to go through parenting plans and custody battles and things like that, because when I got divorced, I was a football coach. So everything in my my divorce is centered around being a football coach. Like, I get the kids in the summer because we have a light schedule, and during football season, I hardly see them. So we're going through that, and my kids are handled like a champ. I mean, I can honestly tell you that I haven't seen them in 3 weeks because their mom weaponizes them against me. She uses them as a way to get back at me, but I think my kids see that. And, that's the craziest thing is going through all this. So many people have reached out on social media that it's either a male that has gone through it, is going through it, or there's been a number of females that know their brother went through it, or their, son is going through it. It's crazy how common it is.
It is. Yeah. What about negatively on social media? I know you're on Twitter a lot. What about negative messages?
Oh, man.
Well, that brings us to a weekly segment we're going to have on here, and it's called Twitter Tough Guys.
The moral of the story is social media has created something that real life doesn't have. It's anonymity.
Exactly.
Because these people would never say what they type in that box and hit send in person, to, probably to anyone. And I can't stand it because here I am. I get blasted all over social media and the media, which is, I mean, it's fine. I signed up for that life. But then these people think they have the anonymity to just, I mean, say hateful things to me. Yeah. And there's been several instances where people that I know, friends of mine, they get defensive and they do a little research and it's like, rut-row, you better calm down, buddy. We just found out some stuff about you.
For sure. For sure.
So our first Twitter tough guy is a man that I didn't even know was attacking me on social media. He was responding to tweets, saying things like, put down the bottle, alcoholic, and I bet your girlfriend's tired of hearing these stories, and then he put dumpster fire gifts and all kinds of stuff. I mean, it was like probably 5 to 10 tweets. I mean, all like it was like for about
back to
a
back to back.
Yeah, a month.
Always, yep.
And so I didn't even notice it. And then someone brought it to my attention that it was my girlfriend's ex-boyfriend's brother-in-law. I'm sitting here like, come on, man.
What does that even mean?
Yeah. Okay.
So then I find out about this guy, right? So I don't know how specifically accurate all of this is, but I do know that where there's smoke, there's fire, and a lot of this is accurate, and it's just mind-blowing to me. And so the secondhand stories I've heard about this guy just absolutely paint an amazing picture. Apparently, he was a raging alcoholic. He was a GM. You ever been to J. Lou, the restaurant?
Yeah.
Old Dublin?
Yeah, in Old Dublin in Ohio. He was a GM at J. Lou, a nice restaurant. He got fired for sexual harassment there, allegedly. I don't know if this is true, but this is what people that know him very well told me happened. And then after that, he was a manager at Cooper's Hawk or somewhere. He got fired from there for using a racially derogatory term.
No.
And now, my friend Nathan White is a realtor. So if you need to buy a house in Columbus, Ohio, contact Nathan White. Sounds like a real winner. Oh, and also sounds like he should wear a white wig and bang a gavel and judge me.
Throwing stones.
Man, that's crazy.
God.
That's people for you. That's people for you, though. They'll attack you and judge you and criticize you when they probably should just look in the mirror and try to do better. And what the craziest part is, what I found out about him too, is I think like recently he's kind of turned his life around and doing better, which is the craziest part, right? If you went through all of that, did all that, that's your life story and you turned it around, shouldn't you just shut your mouth and hope the same for someone else?
Yeah, no.
Right? Like just be a better person and hope that somebody who's going through something can better their life like you have, apparently.
He's the only one that's allowed to do that.
No, yeah, no one else thought.
Man.
Oh, but it was a nightmare. There's a lot of negativity, and the whole thing was just it was wild. But and we'll get in much more detail into everything that happened, just minimally at a time, because I don't want to spend a whole podcast talking about that situation. But
yeah,
it's just I can't believe it all happened, to be honest with you.
Well, how do you feel about how Tom Herman kind of made the whole thing get going?
Yeah, it's. In the big picture, it's crazy because
I know.
Like when he was at Ohio State, he was obviously the offensive coordinator, wildly successful, brilliant coach, great coach. And him and I were tight. I mean, we were the youngest guys on staff. We worked hand in hand together, obviously quarterback, receiver coach. Mm-hmm. We went on the road recruiting, well documented. We went on the road recruiting together. And he definitely, something happened. And I know he has a lot of things in his relationship that we'll get to at a later date for sure. But that made him sympathize with. I don't even know if he sympathized with my ex-wife, but his wife. His wife was good friends with my ex-wife, and somehow that severed our relationship. I never did anything to him, and even after he left for Houston, we were still friends. We were still tight. We had a good relationship, and then I guess. My ex-wife got to his wife, got to him, and I don't know if she told him that he couldn't be cool with me. I don't know what it was,
probably.
But out of nowhere, he just kind of cut me off, and I never knew why. He never really told me why. And then one time I texted him, so this is going to go against his narrative now. I think it was in 2016, finally, I texted him. He had come to the Fiesta Bowl, came up to my hotel room, because my ex-wife was staying in my hotel room with my kids. All of us went on the bowl trip. I know I was this domestic abuser, yet for some reason she stayed with us at the bowl game.
So him and his wife came up to see her and the kids, and he was gave a real weird vibe. And I kind of got pissed about it. So I texted him afterwards. I was like, "Bro, I don't know what I ever did to you, but like what's the deal? Like, we don't have to be friends, but do you have to be so cold? And I've never done anything to you." And he texted me back about how he could never respect a man that hit a woman. And so that whole narrative, he knew nothing about it. Bullshit. I have the text still. He texted me and said that was why, which is fine. If he believed his wife who believed my ex, that's fine. That's a valid reason not to like someone. But now don't come out on your high horse at Texas and say, "I knew nothing about it." Yes, you did. Shut your mouth. But it was definitely the wildest thing is when people know about other people's skeletons, usually you don't want to sever that relationship.
Right, exactly.
Right.
I had a similar thing with his wife, because we used to, when I would go to games, we would hang out, we'd joke around, and then the next year, all of a sudden she was just cold.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Hey, Michelle, how you doing?"
Yeah.
Walk away.
Yeah, I mean, she never did anything to me, and that's why it was real funny, because after I went, I kind of went after him on Twitter. And that's a whole nother story. But after that, I saw my ex posted that he just is going after my good friend. Another example of him going after a woman. Like, what?
Oh, jeez.
I'm not going after Michelle. I don't give a shit about Michelle. I was talking about Tom Herman. I didn't say Michelle Herman did it. I said Tom Herman cheated on his wife because he did. I don't care. I don't know what Michelle did, nor do I care.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So that whole Twitter tirade, what came of that? Is there any backlash from Tom or like... anything that people don't know?
Well, there was so that whole Twitter tirade was fueled because Tom knows that I know so enough about him to cause him some issues or cause him some drama, and so he had a mutual friend come talk to me, and our mutual friend presented it as a business opportunity. He knew I was out of a job, and so we sat down to meet, and then some of it was about some business stuff that I don't know how valid it even was or real it was. And then it turned into like this talk about like the fraternity of coaches and how you don't cross someone else in the fraternity.
Like mafia stuff.
Yeah, it was like, whoa, I was like, time out, bro. And then I left, and it was no big deal because I really liked the guy that I met with. I mean, he's a friend of mine. But then I started thinking about it. I was like, hold on, man, you're giving my ex-wife money to ruin my life. And now you're sending someone telling me to be quiet? Okay.
Yeah, right.
And what? It was wild. And the aftermath was wild, too.
Yeah. What kind of responses did you get after that?
Well, so...
on Twitter.
We put out a teaser earlier, and I want to play you this audio. So here's the backstory. So obviously everyone knows what I've tweeted, right, about Tom Herman and things that I did with him, strip clubs in Fort Lauderdale, Dallas. Judge me if you want to. We went. And just so we're clear, that's not the only times I've been to one.
People go to strip clubs.
I mean, and if you don't, that's fine too.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and I don't care. I'm not backing down from it. But also, when we were in Dallas, we went and we were at the Renaissance, I think. And we went there, and as we're there, in walked these two attractive older, I don't say older, they're not older, but two women, right? Mm-hmm. They're clearly flight attendants. They came over and sat down with us right as I had paid my check, because I have family in Dallas. So I was going to meet two of my cousins who live in Dallas, going to go have a beer with them, hang out, because I don't get to see them much. And that was that. And then I'm getting texts from a couple of the coaches that were there, and this one guy who I just knew was Tom's friend. I don't know who he was. He's texting me like, "Oh, this is wild. This chick is doing this. This girl's doing..." And I'm like, wow. What is going on? So anyways, I go back to the hotel, go to sleep, come to find out Tom had cheated on his wife with her one of the several times. And that was that. I kind of forgot about that story entirely until I went on this Twitter tirade. And then out of nowhere, this woman messages me.
One of the flight attendants?
The flight attendant.
Oh, no way.
And that was the teaser that we put out earlier. And so I want to play you the audio right now.
So don't think I haven't just met up with him in one city. She was always like, "Where are you? Oh, so-and-so's here. Go there. They'll buy your drinks."
Right.
And as a flight attendant, I mean, we make good money, but I want to go out and have drinks.
Right. Absolutely.
So that's how the conversation started.
Yeah, so essentially she's trying to find somebody to go have drinks with, and, you know, whatever happens.
And what I didn't know at the time when I was there was that this was not just a random hookup. This was several flight attendants. So this girl went to college with a DFO at a small school in Texas, right? who worked with a handful of coaches at another small school in Texas. So once all those coaches ended up making it, Tom Herman being one of them, he kind of set all this up. It was almost like a pimp.
Yeah.
Like a prostitution.
Like he provides them with flight attendants who are going to go out and have drinks.
Right. So he would tell.
Oh, they'll pay for those drinks.
Right. He would tell these coaches, you know, let me know when you're going to Dallas. They would all schedule together. This week, we're all going to be in Dallas. Then he would let his girl know, this flight attendant, they're going to be in Dallas this week. She would get her girls. They would go to Dallas. And it was like this huge orgy or hookup fest in Dallas. Man. It was wild, right? And so she reached out. We had a long conversation. I'm going to play more of it now for you. And it was eye-opening because I just knew it as some girl he hooked up with, right? So let's get back to
fiction.
Yeah. Right. So listen to what
back
else.
Back to the audio.
Listen to what else she had to say, right?
I'm not the only flight attendant he's ever been with.
Oh, I believe it.
It could have been another one.
Well, you never know with Tom.
Okay, so do you want to talk about the sex or are we going to talk about almost getting into a wreck? Okay, well, the sex was terrible. Like, he's super funny and we really got along. But then when we went to, like, do that, it was like, oh, that marriage is a joke. I did like her shirt, though. That was funny. She was giving a little F you. But when you know that, oh, hey, your husband fucked me. Nice shirt.
Right. That's what's funny about it, right?
I know. I'm like, okay.
Right. Cute shirt. Your husband fucked me, by the way.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Obviously, she's referring to the "Okay, cool, hook 'em" shirt,
yeah, right.
And I'm gonna be honest, it was well played by everyone, well played by Tom and Michelle, well played by
Good
Texas.
Job.
The problem is that's embarrassing. Okay, cool, hook 'em. I fucked your husband,
and that is not even the like most important part of that audio, right? Like,
no.
Hey, I fucked your husband. All right, well, he's fucked probably a bunch of different chicks.
She probably
but
knows.
Let's talk about the fact that she said the sex was ew. Yeah. Like, what?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, he's funny.
Mind you, I don't even know this person. I mean, and I remember I got off the phone and I was like, what just happened? Wild.
I mean, you're funny, but.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Okay, so that's Tom Herman, but what about Urban? Like, how was it working underneath Urban Meyer?
So I'll tell you this, he is as elite of a person as he is a coach. The one thing he did extraordinary as a head football coach is he coached his coaches. Like he developed coaches. You just look at the head coaches that have come from underneath him and it's remarkable. And obviously I witnessed it firsthand. He's an elite leader. He set a very clear standard and he had this ability to make everything so extreme. Like everything was fourth and one. Like if the coffee wasn't hot, it was fourth and one. It was what made him great. And I think that's part of what happened to him at Florida was he's so intense and extreme that it's almost unsustainable.
Well, that's
right?
Like what, 4 to 6 seconds of explosive.
Yeah. 4 to 6 seconds, the length of a play, right? 4 to 6 seconds, yeah. A to B, point A to point B. And he's also very good at what you just said. Breaking things down to a very finite, minute detail, yep. and laser focus. I mean, he takes this complicated, chaotic game and just simplifies it and narrow tunnel visions for all players, coaches, everyone, and you just get to work. And I'll never forget. I mean, I was with him for 5 years. So let's just put it this way, and this is called the curse of coaching. I was with him for 5 years at Florida. First of all, I've known him my whole life, right? I was with him for 5 years at Florida in like a GA role. Like I was not a position coach. So I was a support staff for 5 years. Mm-hmm. Then I had a job at Marshall, a job at Temple for 1 year each. And then he brought me to Ohio State I was 27 years old when I got hired. So now I'm coaching the position he coached. He's known me his whole life. And I used to be his GA. That's like the triple death.
Right.
And so I say that, but he also, the coach I was when I walked in the door in 2012 and the coach that got fired are, I don't know, as far away from each other as two coaches could be. That's how much he developed me in all aspects. And I'll never forget the one time, one of my first experiences. So we get there, and the receiver group was the worst receiver group in the history of Ohio State football, which they're the lineage at Ohio State prior to that. I think I did a 17-year study, and there was like almost double the first-rounders out of Ohio State from 95 to 2012 than any school in the country, right? But that was up until like 2000. I don't remember when the last one was, 2008, 2009, something like that. So from 2008 until 2012, something happened, and I don't know what. I mean, I have my opinions. But something happened, and that room just was a mess. So add that on to the list of being the receiver coach in 2012 for Urban Meyer, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're there. We get there. I get hired in December. We're out recruiting, trying to put a class together, do whatever we can. We get back from recruiting, and we go in, and then it's, all right, who are all these guys he hired, right? Like, who we got to get some staff chemistry. We got to figure out what we're calling each play. Like, we have to figure out, we're trying to – do simple math, simple addition before we can get to
trigonometry. Maybe.
Before we can get to geometry or trigonometry or whatever.
Calculus.
Is
the goal.
And so we come in, and I'll never forget, like, the first week was chaos. I mean, Tom Herman's in charge of the offense. He's trying to build chemistry in the staff. We're in there all day long in these meetings. And then I remember a week and a half into it, we go to do mat drill on a Wednesday morning, 5:55 a.m., this crazy workout, putting these kids through it. And he had grabbed Devin Smith, right, who had a really good freshman year, but he was not near the player he ended up being yet, obviously. And so he grabbed him. Here's this kid that ran, I think, 10, 400 meters in high school, which Urban loves speed. And he asked Devin, he said, "Hey, Devin, how much jugs work have you done so far?" This is a week and a half into the job, right? And Devin was like, "Oh, I haven't been on the jugs."
Wrong answer.
He, right after the workout, called Tom Herman and I in, and we were in a corner of the staff room. He's like veins popping out of his neck, just finger in our face, like, "I can't believe I hired you. You're a piece of shit, coaches. I should fire you right now. Matter of fact, you're fired. No jugs. This is Tom, why did I hire? Why did I bring you here? You're okay with a receiver coach that doesn't teach, have him on the jugs?" And I'm sitting here like, oh, shit. Uh-oh. And he went off, fired us both, was in our face. I mean, I think he might have punched a wall. I mean, it was like, you would have thought we lost to the team up north, right? And I'll never forget it, because the minute he walked out, it was like both Tom and I were wide-eyed. And Tom looked at me and goes, "You probably should get him on the jugs." Yeah.
So he's not intense at all.
No. Yeah, no, not at all. But the other thing about him was he didn't care about great coaches or hanging out with coaches, or like they do that coaches cruise for head coaches. He didn't ever want to hang out with coaches and drink beer, hang out. He wanted to get around like Phil Knight. He wanted to get around other coaches like him that think elite. Mm-hmm. And he was always trying to apply things that he learned from business leaders or anyone to coaching. And he always talked about, he was like, "I'm telling you, if you can coach at this level at Ohio State, if you can be the CEO of the receiver room at Ohio State, you could be the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. Because that's how you, it's the same leadership principles, it's the same motivation principles." And he also had genuine care for his coaches and players. Like, he felt like it was his mission for you to be a great head coach if you work for him. Mm-hmm. And if you weren't, and he would say it to me, when his son-in-law came on, he said, "Zach," when you, he pulled me in his office, he said, "When you were a GA, I would have failed you if you didn't become a big-time position coach at Ohio State. That would have been a failure on my part. If he doesn't become a big-time position coach, that's on you." And right. I was like, that's a great way to look at it. It's about, you got to develop coaches. He was great at it.
Yeah, that's John Maxwell, who's one of the biggest leadership people in the world.
Yep.
He has, that's what leaders do is develop leaders, right? A manager develops people into great employees. A leader develops leaders.
That's it. And right. And there's no better example that I've ever seen than him. He did it at an elite level. And sometimes it's hard. You get some older coaches in there that are very successful. He used to say it all the time. The easiest coach was probably someone like me. 27 years old, just wants to be at Ohio State and wants to be great and hasn't been at that level. And he can sit there and develop you and mold you. And that's what he was elite at.
So that gave us a, great introspective into Urban Meyer. But you were also around some of the greatest athletes in the history of college football.
Yeah.
So give us just an insider perspective into some of the great players you've been around. I mean, you've been around some of the greatest players of all time.
Yeah, like craziest insider accounts. I mentioned it at the beginning of the show. Aaron Hernandez is probably the greatest insight into a wild story and a talented kid that I worked with closely. Obviously, I wasn't his position coach, but I remember he used to come for one-on-one workouts at like 5 a.m. with one of his friends that was a receiver who I was working with the receiver coach. And so I would go in there at 5 a.m. and put him through workouts, and it was Aaron and this other kid. And he actually came – well, I think we'll talk about Aaron in another episode, but yeah. I mean, he came to my house on Thanksgiving. That's how crazy it was. So we'll talk about that at a later date. You know who I think is – I don't know. My favorite story is Michael Thomas.
For sure.
He's just – he was built different than other people I've been around. He other players I've coached and even players I've witnessed, he was built different. And he came in, and he always was an elite talent. He always had a lot of talent. He was the MVP of the spring game as a freshman. People forget that. And then he had an okay freshman year, but he was young. He was immature. He wasn't quite ready. But you know what he always did? He always made plays.
So what do you think made him different? Because I know he is, the nephew of
Keyshawn Johnson.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think that played a part into what made him different? Like, what really made him different?
Yeah, so you know what's funny is you see all this stuff about Keyshawn, like, throw me the damn ball. And I, honestly, before I ever met him or talked to him, I was like, this guy is a flamboyant jerk, right? Yeah. That's what he came off as.
Yeah, he came off kind of like a Terrell Owens type.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I'll never forget during Mike's freshman year one time, I'm driving home and this random California number pops up and I'm like, hello. He's like, Coach Smith, Keyshawn Johnson. And I was like, oh, shit, what?
That's pretty sweet.
I was like, huh? And I mean, and I'll tell you this, in dealing with him the whole time I coached Mike, and Mike's dad is awesome. And Keyshawn was phenomenal. Really? And Mike, I think having seen the success Keyshawn had made him so hungry. And then to constantly be labeled Keyshawn's nephew gave him a huge look. He right now, Mike Thomas, probably one of the top three receivers in the league, ridiculous stats, better than anyone ever has, still right now feels like he has a chip on his shoulder. He's underappreciated, undervalued, and people don't think he's as good as he is or could be. And that's what he had. He had an edge. And he used to, so I remember, now mind you, this is when, we just talked about it, the worst receiver group ever, right? Yeah. And I'm trying to get them to buy into this culture and this work ethic, this how you have to grind and how you can't just work 8 hours a week like the NCAA says you can. Like, that's all I can demand, but if you want to be a great player, you got to put in way more than that. And I can't make you, but you have to internally do it. So I would try to get them to I guess, train at this level. And Mike was the one that finally, when it all clicked and he redshirted his sophomore year, his second year there, he redshirted and it clicked. And he went from being extremely talented and kind of all over the place to, it was the biggest, I mean, most instant transformation I've seen. And then he started doing things. I'm talking about, I had to get a key to the lights, to the indoor facility from our facilities guy, put it on a chain and leave it in my office. Cause he would text me at like Saturday night, 9 PM or 10 PM on a weekend off season. And be like, hey, coach, where the key at? Like, where's the key? I'd be like, I'm like laying in bed watching a movie with my kid. Like, I don't know where the key is. And I'm sitting here like, man, I'm asking him to do this stuff. And Mike is on another level. He changed the culture of that whole room. Everything you see, and you ask any receiver that was around him, maybe as a true freshman, like the guys that just went to the NFL, Paris Terry, yeah. Johnny, if anyone asks those guys, they'll tell you Mike changed everything. Because then that became the standard. And that's when I changed my standards because I was trying to get them to reach way above where they were. Mike surpassed it by so much that became the new standard. And that's what everyone was held to. And he was just different. And here's the greatest point to Mike Thomas. One, my daughter had the biggest crush on him. And if she could marry a football player, I would want it to be him. That's how much respect I had for him as a kid and the quality of person he is. But also, he just did things differently. And the best experience I have with that was when he was done with his fourth year, he redshirted, so he could have come back for another year. And he was projected late first, early second round. Most people would tell you, if that's the case, you should leave, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So we had dinner, me, him, and his dad, and he just, all he talked about was how he wanted to come back. How, and he wasn't talking about, I'm trying to leave, or what are you going to do for me? Am I going to get the ball, or nothing like that. All he kept talking about was his legacy, and he was, it was killing him that he didn't have a tree in Buckeye Grove, an All-American tree.
Because
he should have, but he didn't have the stats for it.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to come back, and I think that was driven by the fact that he used to go with Keyshawn to USC, see his plaque or whatever, and he wanted to be like a top five pick, which he should have been. We can see that now, right?
Well, but, best wide receiver in the NFL.
Jesus, let's just take a moment and realize that the Browns drafted Corey Coleman, top 10, I think it was, in that same draft. Okay. And Mike Thomas is now one of the best three receivers in the league. I think that's pretty well known.
Yeah, I remember I got so pissed that two NFL scouts came to meet with me about Mike, and they were asking all kinds of questions. And I loved it. I'm like, I'm selling my guy. Like, this is my guy. I'm trying to sell him, right? Mm. And after a while, they're just talking about this other receiver. And I finally looked at him and said, let me tell you something. He's the best receiver in the draft. I don't need to see anyone else's film. He's the best I've seen. I'm just telling you, he's the best receiver in the draft. Like, I've already told you everything else about him. If you want to talk about other receivers, go somewhere else. I don't care. I don't care about who else is coming out. He's the best receiver in the draft. And I was like, I'm done. We're good. All right. That's what I think. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I'm out. And I'll never forget that.
I think it's been proven you're right.
But. Yeah, but I might have said that about other guys and been wrong. I'm not going to talk about that.
Love you guys.
All right. Well, other than Urban Meyer, what elite coaches?
Oh, man. I've been around so many elite coaches and so many clown coaches. Not so many clown coaches. Not a ton, but I've been around some clowns. I mean, some of the elite coaches like Greg Schiano's of the world, Larry Johnson's, some guys I was at when I was at Florida, and guy I worked for, Steve Adazio, is ridiculously elite. Was as a position coach, is as a head coach. there's a bunch of them, and I think I'll probably I think we should talk about maybe one an episode.
Okay. What about coaches that you look at and you're like, how the hell is that guy successful?
Yeah,
he's just not good.
Yeah, you come across those. I think the two biggest examples of that is a two-horse race for me. One was a guy named Kenny Carter, who was a running back coach at Florida.
Okay.
And then the other one would definitely, not as a position coach. He was a great O-line coach. I'll say a really good O-line coach. Maybe not great. A really good O-line coach.
Serviceable.
But he got promoted to offensive coordinator at Ohio State. He's Ed Warner, who's now the team up north. And he was the most I don't even know how to put it. He was the most inept person in that role that I've ever experienced or could imagine. It's wild. But I mean, I think we should carve out 20 minutes maybe next episode and talk about Ed Warner, because I have some stories that, I mean, it was wild. And if anyone would talk open and honest, like, you want to talk about 2015, the reason why we didn't win a national championship, Ed Warner, not even up for debate.
All right. We'll save that for the next episode, but just give us one example of something in recruiting. I mean, you were one of the best recruiters in the country, so tell us a little bit about that.
A recruiting story. My favorite story that has to do with recruiting. It's not necessarily like an on the road story. I have a lot of those too, but my favorite story that I've never been able to say publicly until now, because of just, you can't talk about players and schools and all that, was the beef with Nebraska.
Oh, God.
I don't know if you guys remember that. I can't remember the coach. What's the coach's name? Look him up. He was a receiver coach at Nebraska with the coach that was there, whoever it was, 3 years ago.
Hold on, let me get him.
So anyways, I'll give you the backstory. So I was recruiting two kids that committed to us. I was recruiting more than that, but two kids I was recruiting are relevant to the story. One of them was Trayvon Grimes, who there's a big story about that Brett McMurphy did about Trayvon Grimes and his father. We'll get to that on another episode, which I can't wait to talk about. But anyways, Trayvon, great kid, great family. His mom's great, whatever. So I'm recruiting him, and I find out that the University of Florida is after him hard. It's really us and the University of Florida, which is where he is now. This is before Dan Mullen, different staff. And so I'm recruiting him, and then I find out that people at his mom's work that were graduates of Florida are filling her head with all kinds of nonsense. And it was kind of somehow a chain of command people, you know, this person told this person to tell this person to tell that person at work to get in her head from Florida, from the staff, which is great recruiting. I love it. It's not illegal, I don't think, but if it is, they did it. But anyway, so I get pissed, and I'm like, all right, here I am, because I always in recruiting, I was just myself. Like, I didn't do sales. I wasn't like, we're the best school in the country, because that's how most coaches do it. And it's like, bro, you're a clown. So I would just talk to these kids just be real, be normal, and they instantly could feel a connection. We'd develop a relationship, and that's how I had any success I had in recruiting. So I talked to the kid, and I was basically like, listen, you're getting fed a line of bullshit. And I was like, these coaches, sometimes they feed you bullshit. I will right now go on social media and tweet out everything I've told you about our school, and no one can refute it, because I'm just telling you about our school, that about real stuff. So I went off on Twitter about all these coaches talking bullshit to recruits. I didn't say bullshit, but I was basically like, coaches are selling bullshit to recruits. I'll put my everything out here, blah, blah, blah. Well, as I'm doing it, mind you, I'm talking about Florida. I'm telling you right now, and Trayvon Grimes. And if you ever asked him, he would remember this. I am recruiting him on Twitter, talking about Florida and him, right? I'm not allowed to say his name, so I didn't talk about him. But he knew, because we had just got off the phone, that I was tweeting relevant things about him. Mm-hmm. I wake up in the morning and my Twitter is flooded with hundreds of responses from Nebraska fans talking shit. And I'm sitting here like,
why Nebraska?
Nebraska? What? And I wasn't even thinking about this other kid, Tyjon Lindsey, that I'm recruiting, and how he's also looking at Nebraska. I didn't even know what was going on. And then I'm trying to get to the bottom of it, and my GA pulls up. Did you find out the guy's name?
Yeah, I got it right here. It's Keith Williams.
Yeah, Keith Williams. So I don't know this. I've heard he's a really good coach. I don't know anything about him. But apparently, as I'm tweeting this stuff, someone sent it to him, or he saw it, or I don't know. He starts like subtweeting, like replying about it, like tweeting stuff about me and Ohio State. As I'm not even talking about him. I'm talking about Florida. And this guy's going off about it. And like just responding to, he thinks we're in this like anonymous Twitter war, and I'm not even talking about him or Nebraska. It was wild. And so
you got the next defensive, huh?
Oh my gosh. I guess the next day, I went off. I was like, bro, I've never thought about Nebraska one time in recruiting, but I'm good. It was not about you, bro. And I did that Homer Simpson gif where he goes back in the bushes like, right. Yikes, bro. But it was wild. And then it started this huge Twitter beef that I didn't even start.
That's crazy. It was bizarre.
But like I said, I've heard he's a really good coach, and I'm sure it was just recruiting. I nothing against him or anything, but and the kid Tyjon actually ended up going there, which I'll tell you that story another episode.
Yeah, can we hear about that? Because high school with Tate Martell.
Yeah, he went to high school with Tate. I know everything that happened, and there's a lot of stuff on the West Coast with Adidas, boys. Let me just tell you that. You think college basketball's got some dirt? Woo, boy! But we'll save that for another episode. And I know this. Right when I said that, anyone on the West Coast that knows went, exactly. I've been saying that. And they say it on Twitter when I've brought it up before. We'll talk about that another time, though, because I think our time's pretty much up. So I want to end this with just kind of a closing statement, just the kind of the first podcast, first recording. I wanted to give you some insider stuff. And I also wanted to provide some insight into where I stand today. I'm not sitting here as an innocent man, not proclaiming my innocence, not trying to fend for my innocence. I've paid for several things I've done wrong in my life. Paid the ultimate, not the ultimate price, but pretty close. The end of a career I dreamt of since I was probably 5 years old. My whole dream, my whole life. My kids have paid for it. My extended family's paid for it. And I own a lot of that. I worked through the issues and things that I actually did wrong and got my life back on track 3 years ago. Unfortunately, I had a vindictive ex-wife who could not take the fact that I was a public figure and experiencing success. What I found out later, she also had a jealous boyfriend. They say everyone likes a comeback story. People tell me that all the time, still to this day. I think that's mostly true. Do you know who doesn't like a comeback story? Someone who wants to see you fail and wants to ensure you do. They don't want to see a comeback. They want to see complete destruction. And when you do come back, to their dismay, then the vindiction and yearning for revenge grows uncontrollably. Well, in my case, in a lot of cases, the desire to see you burn outweighs anything else. The desire to be happy. What's best for their own self-interest. What's best for their own children. Doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with needing to be heard. Not in my case, it doesn't. Not with my ex-wife, it doesn't. And what I have found is that my situation is only unique to others similar because of the public platform it was thrown into. I have had hundreds, maybe 1,000 people reach out with similar stories on social media and email. And that is why I'm trying to add this topic to the litany of things we intend on discussing. Because it needs a light shed on this common dark spot in far too frequent of situations. I have so many stories and entertaining experiences that I know people would love to hear. I also have a unique place in my own journey to expose everything I view as wrong with society. Not that I'm some, you know, brilliant man that sees society differently than others. I think people will agree with my take because my take is coming from personal experience and a little bit of pain. I have no reason not to say it. I have freedom, like I talked about earlier. I simply think the way things work today are wrong in a lot of cases, in a lot of venues, in a lot of instances. And after hearing an outpouring of agreement, I know there's a large crowd of people who agree. And to people who don't agree, I respect your opinion. I hope you can listen with a somewhat open mind. If not seeking understanding into me or my views that are shared by others, at the very least, listen for entertainment. Hate me. Talk shit. Doesn't bother me. Send an audio question to us via our website, via our social media. Next week, I want to do a question and answer segment. So send us your questions. Make it an audio clip and we'll put you on the show. We want to deliver the content that you want because I have so many stories. I just want to get the right ones to you. At the end of this, I just want to say thanks for listening. Thanks for giving it a shot. Hope you liked it. If you loved it, we really appreciate you. We'll keep it going. If you didn't like it, go fuck yourself, San Diego.
Menace to society.